Good afternoon. May it please the court, Adam Balick on behalf of Fox Chase LLC and Riverbend LLC. Your Honors, we've raised two issues in this appeal. One is whether under the facts of this specific case, an exception to the economic loss doctrine is applicable, one that would allow the plaintiffs to pursue tort claims against the defendants. The second issue is whether a release executed by a principal of one of the plaintiffs waived contractual claims, as the Superior Court decided. The Superior Court decided, in fact, both of those issues adversely to the plaintiffs.
Would the release, assuming it's broad enough to cover this, would it also release tort claims?
I anticipated that question, Your Honor. Interestingly, the motion to for summary judgment filed limited the court, the Superior Court, to the question of whether or not the release waived the contract claim. Of course, the Superior Court's decision was limited to that question, too. However, this court has a fair bit of jurisprudence on the issue of whether or not a release can waive the tort claim, and in this case, we'd argue that it did not. The court's decisions on that issue require some specificity as to whether or not the release would waive a negligence claim. And although the release in this case talks about any and all claims, it doesn't specifically waive negligence claims. So our position would be that this particular release did not release the tort claims.
Is there case law that says any and all claims does not cover torts?
Well, there is some case law, Your Honor, that I can cite to, if you'll indulge me. I direct the court's attention to J.A. Jones Construction Company versus City of Dover and Slow versus Pike Court Club, Inc. And lastly, to Warburton versus Phoenix Steel. It's our understanding that those claims do require the release to specifically indicate that a negligence claim is being waived, is being released.
Does that mean that a general release then isn't a general release?
I think, Your Honor, as I understand the case law, that a general release that does not specifically speak to negligence claims would not release a negligence claim.
You have a quote you can read from one of the cases for that proposition?
From Slow versus Pike, Your Honor, consistent with this requirement, Delaware courts have found provisions exculpating a party for its own negligence to be sufficiently, quote, crystal clear, end quote, when they include language, quote, specifically referring to the negligence of the protected party.
Okay, well, we can look at those cases. But at least for purposes of argument, you're saying that if you just wrote a general release that says you're released forever from any and all claims, that somehow that does not release claims for negligence.
I think what we're talking about in this case, Your Honor, is a contractual arrangement where the general release was specific to any, well, where we argue that the general release was not broad enough to waive or release the negligence claims.
Well, at any oral argument, we always want to make sure we understand your argument, but we also want to understand the implications of ruling in your favor. So for purposes of what precedent we're establishing, we see many situations where people are involved, we'll say, in a contract, and they have a disagreement, and they want to conclude the disagreement with a settlement and a release. And one of the goals is to be done, one of the goals for the person is to be done forever. And even though your relationship was a contract, you just want to be done for all intents and purposes with regard to all things, and that's why you write a general release. And you seem to be suggesting that if your relationship was a contract and you write a general release that says we're done for all purposes, that that's insufficient if there's a later negligence claim.
Again, Your Honor, I understand the court's question, and all I can speak to is my understanding of the case law, and we specifically researched this anticipating that the court may ask about it, and frankly, we're somewhat surprised to find the cases that we've cited to seem to require that both parties have some understanding about what they're giving up, and that, as we understand the cases that we've cited, a negligence claim, in order to be waived, has to be specifically addressed. As I've said before, with respect, the motion in this case didn't seek or didn't move for the dismissal of the tort claims based on the release. The court, lower court's decision did not address that issue either.
Does this mean your argument is that the under the current case law, this release is not ambiguous? It's clear that unless you specifically address negligence claim, they're simply not included within the phrase any and all claims. Therefore, there's no ambiguity to be addressed by extrinsic evidence to determine what the parties intended by using that language.
I don't know that I considered that question before standing up before you today, Your Honor. My understanding from the case law that I've cited is that the reason that these cases talked about negligence claims being specified in the release is so that there could be some confirmation that there was a meeting of the minds between the parties. And clearly, under the case law that I've read, as I understand it, had the negligence claims been expressly waived or released, there would be no ambiguity. I suppose it follows that we could say that the release is ambiguous, and that some parole or extrinsic evidence could further elucidate that issue.
But your position then would be, after if that were true, as expensive and time consuming and annoying to a trial court as a remand for that purpose would be, your position would be, why would you do that? Because they didn't, after all, move for summary judgment on the basis that negligence claims were barred by this release in any event.
I'm not suggesting that I'm not suggesting what the ultimate outcome would be. What I'm saying is that I don't think the issue was brought before the Superior Court. Returning to the issue of the release, the case law is not disputed by the parties. We agree on what the standard of review is. If the release is clear and unambiguous, the court is to give plain meaning to its terms. And where there is ambiguity, it's to be interpreted against the drafter. In this particular case, we argue that there was language in the release that was clear and ambiguous, and that language limited the release, that it was not a general release. The release drafted by Greenstone in this case, and I'll paraphrase the preliminary language and quote to what I believe is the significant language, the release said that Fox Chase released Greenstone and its assigns from any from all claims, and now I quote, on account of or arising from Greenstone's use or reliance upon any plans, engineering calculations, drawing specifications, and then it goes on to describe the work that was done for Fox Chase at Riverbend. Your Honors, had that phrase not been added to this release, what we would have in this case is the typical general release where Fox Chase would have released Greenstone from any and all claims.
Help me understand that, first of all, it was a drawing that, from your side's view, miscalculated where the wetlands were.
Correct.
And that was a drawing done by Greenstone.
Correct.
So don't they rely upon that drawing in terms of their performance of their contract? And isn't that covered by the release?
Well, there were two contracts in this case, and what has yet to be fully explored is whether Greenstone's work in this case was exclusively limited to the contracts or whether there was other work. But let's focus on the two contracts. The first contract contained two tasks.
Well, I'd like you to get to the point at some point in your answer whether Greenstone's reliance upon its drawing in performing its contract, which you contend is not covered by the release.
Well, I think I have two responses to Your Honor. The first is there may have been tasks under the second contract for which Greenstone relied on its own work. But there were also tasks, we allege, that were provided where Greenstone did not rely on its own work. And frankly, Your Honor, what we're saying is whether or not Greenstone was released from its own reliance on its work, we were not released from relying on its work. The municipal agencies that relied on their work didn't release claims. The contractors that we engaged who relied on Greenstone's work weren't released. So if I understand the court's question, yes, there were probably things done pursuant to the second contract where Greenstone relied upon its own work and for which they're released. The claims in this case, we argue, are not about those matters. They're about different matters.
What would be the basis to ever sue Greenstone for reliance upon its own work that they would need a release for?
I can't find one, Your Honor. And if what the court is asking me is how do we make sense of this release, I'd love to have an opportunity to develop some extrinsic evidence to explore that. Discovery was cut short in this case as a result of the filing of the motion for summary judgment. But I think
before we leave that, can you explain how that happened? It would seem to me when there's ongoing discovery and someone files a motion for summary judgment, which alleges there's no dispute of fact, that it would be incumbent on you or whoever's on the other side to say, the motion's premature. We're still taking discovery, and we may uncover disputes of fact. How did the discovery process get truncated?
I don't have a good answer for that, Your Honor. My recollection is that we did assert that the motion for summary judgment was premature, but it went forward anyway. Shall I move on, Your Honor? So you know, just coming back to the court's question for a minute, I think we could come up with a factual scenario that explained what the purpose of this release was. It would be speculative for me to stand here before the court and allege what I think is a reasonable factual scenario for why this release was written in the way that it was, because it's not in the record. But I do believe that because discovery didn't continue, we were deprived an opportunity to develop extrinsic evidence that would have helped the trial court.
And that would be apart from the transmittal of electronic information for which there was a separate release?
Correct. My guess is this was a form and that it was miscompleted. My guess is that where it said released from Greenstone's use of the material, that it was meant to say engineers' use, which would have meant subsequent engineers, CEA's use of the material. That would have made sense. That would have been consistent with our understanding of why these releases are used, consistent with the explanation that our expert provided in the matter below. I see my time is running short, so if I may, unless the court has any questions about the release, I'd like to talk about the economic loss doctrine.
Go ahead.
The jurisprudence in Delaware on this exception to the economic loss doctrine that's found in Restatement of Torts Second 552 has essentially required courts thus far to look at the end and aim of the work that the defendant was providing, and has historically tried to reach one harmonious conclusion about whether the work was as information supplier or as design for, you know, construction or plans. But few, if any, of the cases that have been decided to date, and none, of course, by this court, have addressed the circumstance where there are two distinct purposes to the work, two completely distinct purposes. And our case illustrates that about as well as any because, as I've said earlier, we have two distinct contracts. And in one of those contracts, the tasks that we've directed the court to were, to use the district court's phrase, were purely information supplying tasks.
They were, that you mean the information would be the location of the wetlands.
Correct. So if you look at the first contract, what the contract says is that, among other things, Greenstone, which again drafted this agreement, Greenstone will attend meetings, will interact with regulators. Greenstone, in fact, engaged another engineering company to flag the wetlands. The proposal that they entered into with that company, JCM Landmark, made it clear that the plans that were going to be the wetlands that were going to be flagged were going to be used on plans that would be used to communicate with regulators and municipalities. Respectfully, we think the district court in Delaware Art Museum went too far when the court said, if you fall outside of the exception, if you do something that's information supplying, but you do another thing that is in furtherance of construction or manufacture, that you fall outside of the exception of 552. We believe, whereas here, where there are two distinct functions, if you assume that the economic loss doctrine would preclude recovery for those services that are not information supplying, the reasonable remedy that should be available to a plaintiff is that for those services where the plaintiff engaged the expert to communicate information, that the exception to the economic loss doctrine should apply.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I would. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Patrick McGrory from the law firm Ty and Cottrell on behalf of the underlying defendants, Greenstone Engineering and Bruce Jones.
And do you agree with the proposition put to us early in Mr. Bailick's presentation that you assume in the event of an ambiguity in the construction of the release that because you drafted it, the ambiguity is to be resolved against you?
Well, I don't know if that's dispositive, if there is an ambiguity that it's just purely resolved against. I think that there is an inference that you could resolve it against us, and maybe I'm incorrect about that, but I don't know necessarily what the ambiguity is that would be resolved against us.
Well, I'm asking you, for the purpose of my question, assume that the release is ambiguous. That means it's susceptible of two reasonable interpretations. Do you believe that if your reasonable interpretation is X and theirs is Y, Y wins simply because actually drafted the contract or the release?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and especially in this case, because I think
But it was represented that you both agreed on that. You do not agree with that?
That we both agree
both
on...
Both parties agreed that you as the drafter would bear the burden of, in effect, losing if there's an ambiguity in the release, that the release is subject to two reasonable interpretations. You as the drafter lose because simply there's an ambiguity. The other reasonable reading prevails.
Provided there's another reasonable reading, that may be the case, Your Honor. And
well, I don't want to know whether it may be. I want to know whether you have, as represented, conceded that point.
I don't believe I have, Your Honor, okay. in our papers that we've submitted already okay. and here today.
I just want to get that clear.
And one of the reasons for that is that in their alternative view, if there is an ambiguity, they still lose. Because as the court has pointed out, the reliance that they're alleging caused their damages was Greenstone's reliance on its earlier work. So if their reading of the or the release is correct, they lose. It's been released. That's what they're alleging this. They're alleging that it's not an ambiguity, that it's clear that's what it states.
So your position is there were two contracts. The first one located the wetlands, and the second one was more for site work and actual physical things, and that as a result of Greenstone's reliance on its initial determination of the wetlands, it got the development in the wrong place that led to the cease and desist order. And if that's where we are, it's still covered by the release.
If their allegations are true, and those are their allegations, and I don't agree necessarily that under the first agreement that Greenstone was charged with identifying and flagging the wetlands. Under the second agreement, they were doing that. I mean, and the court can clearly read what the agreements state, and the agreements in the very first agreement, what I'll call the preliminary plan agreement, had four different tasks. One of them was providing a site evaluation and a review, so it's simply evaluating the site. There's no flagging of the wetlands. That was already done by the then-present owner with another engineering firm a few years before. They'd already flagged it. They'd already done a jurisdictional determination with the federal regulators as to where the wetlands were. There was a few other tasks in that first, none of which included flagging the wetlands. Flagging additional wetlands occurred under the second contract in 2006. So to the extent
that that was actually done by a subcontractor.
A subcontractor of Greenstone, correct.
Well, how does the release, taking the literal language of reliance upon drawings produced by Greenstone Engineering, LLC, the actual reliance is not on Greenstone, it's on the subcontractor, isn't it?
And this is probably where Section 552 of the Restatement of Tort is getting a little overlooked and a little stretched, because there is, it does enable a party to bring a claim. And
well,
it's not the part...
I'm not focusing on economic loss, I'm focusing on the release itself. So. Why would the release cover your client's reliance on the subcontractor?
Well, because as the engineer of record, we're tasked through the owner to provide certain work. Whether we subcontract it or not, it's still our responsibility. It's our drawing that we're setting forth saying, so all the information that the subconsultant that flagged the wetlands is given to us, we put it on our drawings and we take responsibility for it. So
well, you're saying at the point of the release, Greenstone had generated the drawings locating the wetlands based on what the subcontractor had provided. And by doing that, it really was Greenstone's work also.
Correct. Correct. And, you know, to address whether, as the court questioned plaintiff's counsel earlier, whether this release included a waiver of the tort claims as well, and I believe I said in our answering brief that I think that if it does, it also includes, you know, the tort claims as well. If the release is to be upheld, it also includes the tort claims as well. But and I'm not familiar. Well, I'm familiar with J.A. Jones slightly, but maybe not for this point. I believe all of those cases talk about a prior release of future negligence. The courts wanted to ensure that the parties, when entering into an agreement that would release future negligence claims, that they were specifically and sufficiently clear so that there was no question later on about the intent of the parties and as to what they were giving up. And even with respect to construction claims, I believe there's a statute which would then expressly deal with prior releases of negligence, of your own negligence, in a construction case. So I don't even think those cases would apply in this scenario, but I'd be happy to look into them more closely. Or
that's because the negligence that would be the basis of this claim had already occurred under the plaintiff's theory?
Right. It had already occurred. It's as Your Honors had already pointed out, there is a dispute. The parties wish to resolve it and end it forever. And that's the way they do it. They release all claims. It can't be any more clear than that. And I think that's clearly allowed and has been upheld.
But is it accurate that you did not rely on the release as to the tort claim?
I am not 100% certain in the underlying motion for summary judgment, Your Honor, whether that was true or not. I did not see that in any of the opening briefs, so I didn't actually look at that. And it was also in the court's opinion, so I didn't know if that was an issue up on appeal as far as waiver of that issue in the underlying court.
You would know the second part of that, which is whether the trial judge addressed it or not.
I don't believe that. I believe the trial judge did address them separately as the breach of contract and the release and the tort claims and the economic loss doctrine. So I believe opposing counsel is right that the court did not address them, the tort claims, within the confines of what the import of the release was. Yes.
Okay.
And as far as the release is concerned, as opposing counsel has pointed out, they're claiming basically two different arguments. One, that it's not ambiguous, that it's clear, that it only releases Greenstone's reliance on its own work. And I, as you pointed out, I cannot fathom or comprehend any sort of scenario where that makes sense. And opposing counsel agreed that there's really no alternative set of facts where that sort of an agreement would make sense. So I would argue that it's just not a reasonable interpretation that the court should even entertain, whether the underlying court or this court. Second of all, they do argue ambiguity, and the first argument on ambiguity is, well, if it's not clear that it releases Greenstone's work, then at least it interjects a modicum of ambiguity that should have been resolved or precluded resolution at summary judgment. But again, it's got to be a reasonable interpretation. As they stood here today, they couldn't come up with any set of facts that would have made their interpretation reasonable, where it would have applied. And then the last one is that they believed, or at least alleged, that they believed that it was of the release for electronic media, that through a Scrivener's error, possibly, where it said Greenstone, it should have said other engineer. And again, the problem with that is that there was already a release of electronic media. There was already a release for the other engineer. That release was entered into 2 months before this release was. They stated an oral argument, and the judge said, what is your best case scenario for the set of facts in order to determine, you know, how there could be some ambiguity here? They said, well, it's that Mr. Capano, the plaintiff, the principal of the plaintiff, was being held over a barrel. He had to get his project done. He had no other choice but to sign this release. I think that in itself indicates that he knew the import of it. He knew what he was signing. He had already gotten the release of the electronic media, so his new engineer was already proceeding along, was able to obtain the electronic version of the engineering drawings that Greenstone had done, but he knew and didn't want to sign this. And why? Because he knew it was a general release. That's their best case scenario that they put forth to the court below. I don't think there's any ambiguity here, and I don't think any further discovery on that issue would have shed light on it. They had 2 years, 3 years, with full access to their clients to come up with their best case scenario, and that was it. And it, I think, doesn't interject the appropriate level of ambiguity or dispute of a material fact that would have precluded summary judgment, as the lower court found. So the second argument that they make, at least with respect to the tort claims now, is that the economic loss doctrine, or I'm sorry, the economic loss doctrine, while it may apply, the exception, the 552 restatement of torts exception, would apply to allow them to bring tort claims. And I don't know if they're arguing that allows Fox Chase to bring a tort claim, but certainly there would allege that allows Riverbend LLC to bring a tort claim, because recall, Fox Chase actually has the contract with Greenstone. So if Riverbend LLC is able to allege or support the theory that Riverbend was not a pure information provider, and therefore 552 of the restatement of torts, restatement second of torts would apply, then Riverbend would be able to bring its claim in tort, not relying on the contract, and the case should go forward, as they state. But since for very long, well, since 1992, well, originally in 1992, and Danforth v. Acorn, this court adopted the economic loss doctrine.
Help me understand how this ties in or is to be distinguished from professional negligence.
I don't believe there is a difference between professional negligence and negligence. It's the same claim. There is a separate claim under the Restatement Second of Torts, Section 552, for the professional negligent misrepresentation. And it enables another party to bring a claim directly against a professional who provides information to a third party, which they then provide to this other, to the plaintiff, we'll call them, for their use. So it enables, it envisions a professional providing information to party A, who then party A provides this information to party B. Party B relies on it to their detriment, and therefore they can sue the professional directly without going through the normal chain, or they would sue the person who gave them the information, who sues the design professional in this case. That's different than...
So there's no, for engineering and engineers and architects, there's no direct professional negligence claim?
Well,
the economic loss doctrine doesn't allow it?
No, you can, well, there's no direct negligence claim by the party with whom they contract. There's a breach of contract. Because implied within every contract is the obligation to perform your duties in accordance with the applicable standard of care. And implied in every professional contract or contract for professional services. So that quasi-tort standard that you're going to perform in accordance with your professional standard of care is already implied in the contract. So as far as a breach of contract, you can allege you failed to adhere to the applicable standard of care as required by the agreement. And it enables the parties in those sort of situations to enter into contractual relationships and still allocate the risks and the benefits amongst themselves, but still know that as a professional, the services that you're providing will be held to the standard that a normal professional is held to in this area. And I believe that's a Seiler v. Levitz decision, and I don't believe I've cited that in these documents, but it's Seiler v. Levitz. So that's implied in every agreement. There doesn't have to be a separate negligence claim. For example, in this case, if it was simply Fox Chase could sue Riverbend for breach of contract. And all of the implications of the standard of care and the professional obligations of an engineer come into play. So that, we also don't concede that you don't have to specifically allege all of the elements of 552, which I, for purposes of the summary judgment, while I don't concede it, and purposes of this case or this appeal, I don't concede it, understanding that they could just amend their complaint and without wasting time, I didn't say they failed to allege it, therefore they're precluded from arguing 552 of the restatement of torts. But the economic loss doctrine is simply about holding the line between contractual associations and the general tort obligations. People with whom they don't have an agreement, an engineer doesn't have an agreement, don't have the ability to, ahead of time, allocate the risk amongst themselves of one party performing or not performing. They don't have that ability, so therefore, tort claims arose to protect their interests and allow the party who was sufficiently responsible for their damages to be held accountable directly to them. In this case, we have Fox Chase. We have an engineer. They have plenty of time to enter into a voluntary, mutual economic arrangement where they could allocate the risk amongst themselves and determine what would happen if either party didn't perform. And therefore, they should be held to the terms of the contract, and the contract should control the outcome of either party not performing. And that really applies to both the release and the original agreements. I mean, in essence, they're both simply just agreements. And on one side, we have the plaintiff trying to do whatever they can to get out of what ultimately happened because of the agreement they entered into. And on the other hand, we have the defendants who are simply just trying to uphold the agreements and say, look, this is the deal you made. Sorry if it didn't meet your expectations, but you've got to hold yourself to the agreement. So with that, thank you all for your time, and we would hope that the court would affirm the grant of summary judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, a couple of responses. The first thing, I guess, that struck me during the appellee's argument is that in answering the court's questions, there's been a lot of discussion about extrinsic evidence, evidence outside the four corners of the release. What the plaintiff's expert said the release meant, what Mr. Capano may have believed or didn't believe it meant. And, you know, it seems to me that the issue is either squarely decided within the four corners of the release, or if it can't be, then you go to extrinsic evidence. And as I said during my earlier argument, the record is incomplete as to that extrinsic evidence. There's been no opportunity to take depositions of the drafters of the release. There's been no opportunity to take further depositions of experts who may have some familiarity with these releases.
But the trial judge did not rely on extrinsic evidence.
It's funny, the trial judge did make reference, although it may have been a passing reference, to what Mr. Capano's level of sophistication was in the context of whether he understood what he was releasing. And there was a cite to some cases that say that the standard is really not what the plaintiff believed it said, but what a reasonable person would have believed it said. But there was at least one passing reference in the court's decision on that.
Its holding was based on the release was based on the four corners of the document.
Correct. That's true.
Thank you, Mr. Baylor.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.